Meeting of the House of Social Service Committee to order. It is 3:05 p.m. Thursday, January 31st, 2013. Present are Representative Keller, Representative Pruitt, Representative Seaton, Representative Reinbold, Representative Nyack, Representative Tarr, and myself, Representative Higgins. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum. Let's see here. Let's recognize our staff today. We've got Butch Carver is the House Recording Secretary. The LIO moderator will be Alex
Juche.
And Paul Verhagen is my committee aide. Let's start with a little housekeeping. Everybody, let's disable our electronic devices. If they're left on phone or vibrate, it could interfere with our recording devices. Wouldn't want that to happen. All right. So today we have a new bill, HB 53, Consultation for an Opiate Prescription, sponsored by Representative Keller. I do not intend to move this bill today. I will entertain a motion to adopt a blank committee substitute you have before you as the working document.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the blank committee substitute, which should be version C, as the working document for our meeting today.
Hearing no objections, the motion is approved for the purpose of discussion. The sponsor, Representative Keller, and his aide, Jim Pound, will, I guess, they seat themselves at the front of the table. If you'll just address the committee with your name and your affiliation, and we'll go from there, and let's hear what you have.
Thank you, Chair Higgins and House Committee. I'm Representative Wes Keller, District 7 representative, and this is my staff, Jim Pound, and when he speaks, he will go ahead and re-identify himself so the recorder gets it.
I'm sorry, is the mics on? I mean,
I can talk a little closer. Would that help? Yeah, I'm sorry. Do you want me to go ahead and make an opening comment?
Floor is yours.
Okay, again, thank you for hearing the bill. It's about using or prescribing, I should say, pain medications. I think all of us have used Narvon, Oxycontin, some of the opiates. I want to start with a couple things. One is, because the CS for this bill has just been out less than 24 hours, I asked Chairman Higgins to not move it, and like he said, invite testimony. It's a work in progress. I think it's an important one, and part of the reason for that also is that I'm not a pain med doctor. I'm not even a doctor. So I'm learning as I go, and my staff, unfortunately, is not a doctor either. So anyway, so we need the input, and I also asked the department not to take a position on this bill yet, but to rather give us input and see what we can do. Now, the reason, everybody asked me why I'm doing this, what's driving the bill, and the reason is I serve on the Alaska Health Commission. We had testimony in the Alaska Health Commission that described in pretty good detail the very negative effects on people who take too much of this category of drugs. And the one that jumps to my mind that I think you'll probably hear in testimony today it was based on workers' comp data, that some patients that have been on some of these too big a dose of these pain meds for 6 months have a 1-2% chance of ever going back to work. It just rearranges their whole lives, and it's just so my concern is not so much the abuse of prescription medicine, the illegal abuse of prescription medicine, so much as it was to just ensure that we aren't innocently hurting people with a overdose. So anyway, like I say, we've probably all taken some of these pain meds. It isn't intended to single out any brand or any particular one. There's different names for it. They call it opiates or opioids, and they're naturally occurring alkaloids that are found in the opium, in opium poppy. They're addictive, and what happens, of course, is in the record show that a lot of your patients have an ever-increasing dose. And that is one of the warning signals. The way we have approached the problem, and my staff will give you a detailed run through of the bill. One of the ways is that we put a level, and it's based on what we have learned of 120 milligrams of opiate, or I mean, morphine equivalent, and that is a level above which, you know, the risks get higher for the patient, and below which it's not as big a concern. You'll get testimony on that. At that level, then it requires consultations when there's a higher level prescription. And you'll see in Jim goes through the bill here, the different ways or different types of people, pain medication experts that can give feedback on or give provide these consultations. So the 120 milligram level is the trigger when that happens. With that, I would just like to go in right into the bill and describe, have Jim describe what's in it, and then you're going to get a lot of testimony, I'm sure, pretty sure, and then we'll try to pick up the pieces and go from there, if that's okay. Is there any questions for me first before I proceed?
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, there's been a number of studies that recently come out, military and otherwise, about OxyContin. Now, this specifies opiates. Is that mean that pain medication is, we're only talking opiates, or are we talking all pain medications, and is OxyContin included in the term opiate?
Again, I'm not the expert on this, but it includes a spectrum of drugs, and like OxyContin is under that category, as I understand it, as is Darvon, Vicodin. And as far as specifically what it is, it's an alkaloid found in opium poppy, and I suppose there's synthetic versions of that, and I'm not going to be able to give you a very technical or scientific answer to that, Representative Seaton. So if you would listen for that in the testimony.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Steer him towards something.
Representative Pruitt. I just wanted to steer you towards some of the information they provided. They did provide a little sheet that said what are opiates, and I think it addresses specifically oxycodone, which, while derived from opiates, are not opiates themselves. So I hope that answers, but it should be in the packet, some of the stuff that they gave.
Can I let Jim proceed then?
Yep, go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Keller. For the record, my name is Jim Poundstaff, Representative Keller. Primarily what I'd like to deal with is when you first got this bill, if you saw the original HB, I think it was 4 pages, and now we're up to 15. And that is a lot of what has been going on, is that this bill has generated a lot of telephone interest and a lot of email interest, in that people from their industries, people from the medical profession, had discussed with us about the language and how we did it, and we had kind of lumped everyone together, where what we have here were medical professionals who have their own boards and have their own rules in those boards, such as the pharmacy board has one, nurse practitioners has one, the dental board has one, and of course the medical board has it for doctors. And so what we essentially did is we took the same language, the same rules, so to speak, for the statutory perspective of it, and split it out between primarily those four groups, primarily the three, nurse practitioners, medical professionals, and then dental dentists. They're the ones that actually write the scripts, and then it's a separate one for the pharmacists, because they're the ones that have to read them. And so they have their own set of rules. Additionally, in finding more information as we went along, we had to figure out a way that people could, everybody indicated the biggest problem is the ability to track individuals. My understanding is called phishing, that these people will go from doctor to doctor and get a prescription and then go to one pharmacist, and then maybe they'll pay cash for it at one pharmacy, and then they'll go to another doctor, and then I'll pay with a credit card at another pharmacy, and for whatever reason, whether they, because they need more medication as far as their pain is concerned, or whether they have other uses for the, to sell it on the street or whatever, they tend to get more than what they're prescribed as their actual prescription. In 2008, when this partially was addressed in the beginning, we created the controlled substance database, which is handled by the Department of Community and Economic Development. And that database is set up in such a way where they have a list of the people, and they're supposed to have a list of the people, a list of the doctors who are licensed to issue opiate-type painkillers. And what we intend for them to do is to be able to check that database and determine whether, if I were to walk in and be fishing, that they could come up and see that Jim Pound has, in fact, been to see three other doctors to get this same prescription filled, and they can deal with it. You have an addiction problem, not a pain problem. And the purpose of this is really the fact that these are addictive drugs. I mean, they are just as addictive in the long run as they're on the street brothers, heroin and opium. And people, and the problem is a growing problem, not only here but across the country, where individuals are taking these drugs for the pain. The prescriptions are going up, and at 120, we looked at 120 milligrams as a number, which in the CS, in the original bill, we didn't have a way of defining it. The definition we have come up with is 120 milligrams morphine equivalent, and that basically, because in some cases, as some of the people have told me, 120 milligrams of one particular opiate is just fine, and 120 milligrams of another opiate will kill you. So we tried to come up with language there that would give us something to work from as a standard. This bill also includes language for methadone users, for what they call maintenance methadone users, which are primarily people who are addicted to drugs, and they're going through the cleanup process, and they're going to clinics to get methadone. It's not, and it doesn't fall into the guidelines of pain management per se, but the problem there is, has been in the past, is the communications level. The clinics tend not to refer to their people as patients. They refer to them as consumers, and they don't really necessarily attach a name to it. They attach a number to the individual for confidentiality. The problem that's been happening is that we have methadone users who are getting the medication from a clinic. They go in to see a doctor, and the doctor is unaware, their primary care doctor is unaware that they're on a methadone program. And they say, well, I have this pain, so he or she will prescribe another painkiller, and the individual's overdose on them. And so this is another way of setting up a communication between the methadone clinics and the primary care physicians, which is language we wanted to put in there as well, so that we could prevent this from happening in the future, and getting within the guidelines of the consumer and the guidelines of their confidentiality. We've also included some exemptions that weren't in the original bill. For one, probably the most important one is the end-of-life situation of where, you know, the person is just in pain, and they are, unfortunately, the reality is they're going to be dying soon. There's no reason for them to go through a pain management program. And we also included a window, because we didn't want somebody to walk in and be taking 130 milligrams of something and have to go to a pain management specialist and spend the money, or their insurance company spend the money, or the copays or whatever, for the first four weeks. Takes into account accidents, surgery, things like that, where there's a lot of pain associated with it, and for the first 4 weeks following, the doctors will have the freedom to prescribe the opiate painkillers as needed for that first 4 weeks before dealing with a pain specialist and the costs associated with that. And that is sort of an overview of the CS, and I'll be glad to answer any questions on that if you have them.
Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bill looks at, affecting dentists in practice and other healthcare professionals and nurses. Are we going to hear from the Board of Dental Examiners, the Board of Nursing, and the Alaska State Medical Board?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, that right at the present time, because they're sort of in the same situation. Not today. It's probably the best way of putting it. They got this yesterday when I got it. So.
Okay.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. So I guess I'm looking here at page 3 of the bill, new section 13, or the new, subsection 13. It failed to check controlled substance prescription database created under there before prescribing an opiate. Page 3.
I'm sorry.
Let me get
information down here.
Line 3?
Line 3, page 13. Correct.
No, page 3?
Page 3.
Yeah, section 13.
Right. Through the chair, representing sure. I understand. That's the new language that we've added to existing language, which has to do with the in this particular section, is the dentist will check with the substance prescription database. What I discussed about people who potentially are phishing, where they can check to see that the individual is already receiving painkillers from other doctors or medical professionals.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Yep, go ahead.
And so I guess I'm trying to figure out where the 4 weeks is in this section. That
it is in general language. I had one of these highlighted and I forgot where I put it.
It's back. I think I'm not going to do this. Well, while you're looking, if I could on that, that's one of the things that is going to come up, I believe, is testimony on this prescription database that's online. And as Jim described it, the idea is so that if you have a patient going to multiple doctors, you know, it'll be online and there'll be a basis for looking. And what we need to know, because this refers to, you know, providers to have to do this, we'll probably get testimony on how well that's working. It's a relatively new online system in Alaska. It has been put in place based on, as I understand it, federal funding, and I was understood some state funding. So, you know, that's something we're going to learn as we go. I think it was in the first couple pages, Jim, on the it's in each one where the word 4 weeks is added.
Right. It is in each one, and I'm just having to find it.
It goes through, what it does is it requires the different people that can prescribe to, you know, this requirement is there for them. It includes nurse practitioners, it includes physician's assistants, orthopedists, MDs, and dentists, like you said, and, you know, each area of law that pertains to them, this has been put in. So even though it's a long bill, you'll see a lot of repetition in the language because it's in each section.
Through the chair, the first reference to it is on same page, page 3, line 10.
Line 10.
Opiate after 4 weeks. That is in reference to the dental side of it.
So, Mr. Chairman,
follow up.
So the consultation is after 4 weeks, but the failure to check the controlled substance database is for revoking a license for a dentist or suspending it or reprimand if they don't check the database when they make a prescription. And I guess, and it appears that it's not just over 120, it's any level of pain medication that falls into this category. If a dentist gives a prescription for that, then that's cause for revoking, suspending, reprimanding his license, as I read this.
Through the chair of Justine, I would agree to it the same way.
And so, Mr. Chairman, I think that's something that needs to be flagged because I don't think it would be workable if we're talking about any pain medication within this whole category and not being a large amount. That means the dentist, you know, if the database is down, whatever, maybe then it would just be a reprimand or something. But I guess the other problem is, my understanding is the database expires in August of this year, the funding for that. And so I don't know, I didn't see any fiscal note on extending and expanding the database. Is that the intention of the bill to renew and extend the sunset of the database?
Through the chair of the seat, and again, this is a bill that the department's got yesterday, just like as I did, and as you notice, there's a zero fiscal note from Community and Economic Development, because that was for the original House bill, not for the CS. I'm anticipating that the department will be coming out with a fiscal note, probably for the continuation of the database.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Keller, On that topic, it refers to a section of law and that presumes that this database is in place and functioning. So in a way, it's kind of a there's an indirect connect, and we don't know how that's going to play out, because I believe that's under the Commerce. That's not Health and Social Services that does the puts putting the database together. So the ramifications of the fact that there's an expiration date ahead, you know, has to be dealt with yet in the future, and we've flagged that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tark.
Thank you. I'd asked earlier about the three boards, also the pharmacists, because they are the ones who are responsible. So should I plan to meet with them separately, or do you think we'll try and get those folks before us at a future meeting to respond to how this would affect each of those?
Through the chair, Senator, we're going to try and get everybody in here to testify on this that has an involvement in it, which is okay. Four boards.
Okay, perfect. That'd be wonderful. And my I didn't get that out earlier. My question, did you look at the definition of an opiate as it is in statute right now? And did you consider tightening up the definition? It's not in the bill. There's no changes to that definition. But looked like there might be an opportunity to align the definition a little more with the language of the bill or be more specific.
Chair, let me. I can read it. As from section 1171.900 definitions, mm-hmm. In this paragraph, unless the context clearly requires otherwise, and then it's paragraph 15. Opiate means a substance having an additional addiction forming and addiction sustaining capability, similar to morphine, or being capable of conversion into a drug, having addiction forming or addiction sustaining capability, and B includes its racemic and, I didn't read this in advance, I apologize, laboratory forms, but C does not include insomnia, and we're getting into words that I don't know. I apologize, I have to yield to the...
No, I have the definition, I have that in front of me, but I just didn't know if you considered trying to align that a little bit more, because it seems like there's a little bit of uncertainty about exactly what would be included under that. At this time.
Right. That's a good suggestion.
You know, after listening to a little bit of testimony here on page 3, line 3 of, I guess, that section 13, and being some of you know I'm in the health profession myself as a dentist, one of the things that I guess I would like to see changed on this one would be not that the dentist or MD or the doc check it, but that the pharmacies do it, because they have a database that when we write a script, they should be the one that should know automatically what's going on. Because I've had phone calls from pharmacies that said, you know, hey, you've given this pain meds to this. We actually have gotten pain meds from another, earlier this week from another doc. You still want to prescribe, you know, and so we see that. So the best way to initiate the database would be through the pharmacies, not through the docs calling it, because first place, we're not going to call every pharmacy in town. We usually just write the script and say, here you go, mm-hmm. You know, you go and do that. So we'd have to do something with that one right now, I can tell. Is there any other questions as far as comments from the committee? All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, yep. Go ahead.
Thank you. And the pain management specialists, we've got a list of 18 pain management specialists in all of Alaska, of which only 4 are outside of Anchorage. That includes 1 in Fairbanks, 1 in Soldotna, and 2 in Wasilla. But I'm not sure that they would be qualified under page 4. Section 4, that's starting on line 23, where it says that the board shall adopt regulations that define the procedure for the board to approve a physician as a pain management specialist. So apparently the people that are currently called pain management specialists may or may not qualify under the definitions that the bill requires the board to adopt, and the credentialing, the minimum of 3 years of clinical experience and at least 30% of their practice directed to provision of pain management care. And so I guess I'm trying to figure out whether there's nothing that says that the board is going to accept the qualifications of the current pain management specialist. This says the board will adopt that a new regulation, which there may only be two in the whole state under that. I mean, I don't know. It's just the way the bill reads, and so I'm flagging these things. I'm not objecting, but it seems like that we don't know. I mean, we were assuming those 18 people that had some kind of certification would be there, but we don't. At least I don't know that those people have 3 years minimum experience and at least 30% of their practices is there. So a number of those might not qualify, and I'm concerned that this consultation that has to take place between the doctor, the patient, and the pain management specialist, even though it can be done telephonically, I don't know if there's going to be enough in the state to handle that. So I just wanted to flag that. And
Mr. Chair, this is Representative Keller's sponsor. In response, again, I really appreciate that you flagging these, and I invite you to, as you hear concerns from constituents or other people, and as you see them, you know, bring them to our attention, and we'll try to bring you a finer work of art here next time. As on that issue, we anticipate that there will be more ultimately qualified specialists than there are now. You know, also, like, for example, the nurse practitioners, hopefully the way the bill reads, and correct me, please, right, Chief of Staff, if you will, but it asks the Board of Nursing to put together standards, you know, to qualify for that. And it does set down this minimum, and your question is well taken. I did hear it, that we want to find out, you know, if we're excluding people that are highly qualified and able and capable and working right now. We'll be looking at that. And we'll be hearing from the nurse practitioners, I'm sure. Sure.
Any other questions from the committee at this point?
All right. If I hear none, then at this time I would like to open the floor to public testimony. And I'd like to remind people, we have a lot of people that want to testify online also, and so we're going to try to get to them. We want to try to keep testimony to 3 minutes. My committee aide will let me know. So let's, you know, we'll kind of wrap it up. And so if there's anybody here that's on the floor that would like to, and I guess we have a Krista Von Berg.
Can we have a brief at ease?
Brief at ease.
I guess we have to call the order, right? No?
No, we just gaveled in. All right, well, let's continue on. Is there anybody on the floor that would like to give public testimony then? And hearing none, let's go to the telephones. And let's see here. We have a Patricia Sinner from Anchorage, Alaska Nursing Association. Are you on?
Yes, I'm on.
All right, if you would please give your name and your affiliation for the record, we would appreciate it.
I'm Patricia Sinner. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. I'm the Interim Professional Practice Director for the Alaska Nurses Association, and I'm a family nurse practitioner. I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify. We just got the committee substitute today as well, so I'll try to address things. HB 53 is fashioned after regulations that were developed by a group of five Washington boards and commissions, including their equivalents to the Board of Medicine and Board of Nursing. The pain management regulations that were adopted by Washington were far more extensive than what is in House Bill 53. The referral requirement is only one of the provisions that their pain management regulations addressed. They have specific guidelines for how you should assess a chronic pain patient and require that there be a pain plan and that type of stuff. They do not require referral or looking at the database, because they felt their database was only a year old and ours is only a little older than that, and it wasn't reliable enough to require it at this point. So we appreciate including advanced nurse practitioners in the bill. Because AMPs provide about 850,000 primary care visits a year in Alaska. I couldn't give you any figures about how many ANPs are involved in pain management, but we can try to do a survey for that for you. However, we do know that because of the way Alaska statutes are currently written, that nurse anesthetists are listed separately in the statutes than advanced nurse practitioners. And nurse anesthetists are involved in pain management in Alaska, and someone from the Nurse Anesthetist Association will be speaking later. So in your next draft of the bill, you have to should list both advanced nurse practitioners and nurse anesthetists separately. We have several concerns, three main concerns about the bill. One is that, as it was mentioned earlier, when we talked to nurse practitioners, they said, how can you require a referral to pain management specialists? We can't get our patients in as it is, that it takes months and months to get someone in to see a pain management specialist. I have concern for the rural areas and specifically because if I was a pain management specialist, I would be concerned about doing telephone consultations when we're talking about prescribing large amounts of controlled substances. Of the 11 of the 18 current pain management specialists are anesthesiologists, which further underscores the need to include nurse anesthetists in your definitions in the bill. We would also like to discuss the exemptions. The Washington state regulations cover non-cancer pain management. We have an exclusion in this bill of palliative, hospice, and end-of-life care, but not all cancer patients are terminal, and we think that a lot of prescription of opiates is through the oncologist. So we would like to have an exclusion for cancer patients. As was mentioned earlier, our prescription drug monitoring program is new, and it is, they're changing vendors in March. Apparently, it is not real time, so if you enter data today, it may not show up for several days in the future. And the rural areas may have trouble accessing the database. So we think in the long run, it would be ideal to have people consult the database, but at this time, it is not mature enough to make that requirement. In general, I think that because this is such a complicated subject, that I would recommend the legislature do what was done in Washington and that require the various boards involved, including medicine, nursing, pharmacy, dentistry, to come up with some proposed regulations for pain management that is a guideline for practitioners in the state. And I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Patricia, for your time and for calling in. Let's move on with the
question for
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. We've been informed that there were a number of doctors in Washington that will no longer take people that require much pain management because of the complex regulations. Have you also heard that about the Washington situation?
Yes, I have heard that. It has been secondhand, though, so it is hard to say. I did call their commission for medicine, and they have had mixed things. They said one thing, the requirement for the referral is used by some family practice doctors to try to ward off people that are seeking constantly increasing amounts of pain medicine. They can kind of hold the line on them. But I'm sure just the environment in general, that there are general practitioners that are refusing to take pain management patients.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? All right. Do we have a Dr. Chandler on from Anchorage with the American Association of Pain Management?
Hi, this is Dr. Chandler.
All right, Dr. Chandler, you're on.
Sounds like I'm on a race. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to listen to me. I was asked by Representative Reinwald to help, and I was also contacted by the AAPM, the American Association Pain Management, which I do not belong to, who asked me to speak on behalf of this bill. I started pain management in Alaska about 1988 when it wasn't a word. And I've been trying to deal with this for many, many years, and the complications of it are very difficult and very onerous to deal with in the best of circumstances. My fears in this bill are, first of all, I know I told Representative Reinbold about the morphine problem, and that has been resolved. I will be happy to help any way I can to make this regulation or law helpful. But my fear is the unintended consequences of this may be felt throughout the state. Some of them have already been addressed. There are 18 physicians in the state, supposedly, for pain management. I know of at least four that I can name who won't see anybody who has to have medical management for pain control. The difficulty is the numbers you have here don't represent the people who are trying to take care of the problem. And the problem is dealing with the people who are drug-seeking and are diverting medications that we deal with every day. Even if we catch them, deal with them, and take a case to court, we find that they're turned back again. I dealt very closely with the DEA for the last 15 years, and it's very hard to enforce these regulations or laws, no matter how hard we try. Everyone needs to recognize that there are three pedestals that are required for managing these problems. The first being the prescribing physician or dentist or whoever writes the prescription, the second being the pharmacy, and the third being the regulatory agency, which is the DEA. They all have to work together, and since we lost Terry Marquardt in the state, we do not have a representative of the DEA in the state, so we are now back being the redheaded stepchild, and we don't have a great deal of support from the federal government for the problems we're dealing with. The goals of the bill are admirable. We need to have a mechanism of measuring those goals and see if they are helpful or more of a hindrance to the overall intent of the bill. If they are not, I'd recommend that this bill be set as a sunset bill to be able to get rid of it, because once things are in writing, they're impossible to work with. Some of the difficulties have already been voiced, and I think there will be a great deal number more, especially when primary care physicians who are overworked now say, I'm no longer writing prescriptions. The same for dentists and others. And the whole goal of this and the goal of all of our medical support is to take care of the public. And addictive medications, if you want to try to define it, I think everybody is required to be on medications for hypertension, for diabetes, and others that have untold outcomes if they don't stay on them. It blends into chemically dependent people, not just addictive personalities. So I'd really recommend that this bill be looked at very carefully before it goes forward, and then someone keeps an eye on it to see what happens, because this can influence the whole medical care system in the state. Thank you very much for your listening.
Thank you. I think we have a couple members that want to ask you a question. Representative Keller?
Yeah, Dr. Chandler, this is Representative Keller. I'm the sponsor of the bill. I'm also on the committee. That's why I'm asking. I just wanted to tell you that I really appreciate your caution, and I appreciate your suggestion on a sunset clause. I like sunset clauses. It's sometimes it's very easy to do harm rather than good. We're trying to do good, and as I've been impressed with a number of people and number of different areas represented have come to me, wanting to do the right thing here. So that sunset clause is a very good suggestion. Thank you.
Thank you.
After what?
Not
right now.
Not right now. Okay.
After that.
Any other questions?
Okay, thank you. Is that appropriate to thank him?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
Representative Rambo, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Chandler, I just wanted to say thank you. I know you do good for many, many people throughout Alaska for the past many decades, and I just want to thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much for contacting me. I'm half asleep now and don't pay as much attention since I got off the legislative boards. So I appreciate you calling me, and I really want to help if I can.
All right. Thank you. Emily Neon from Anchorage, the American Cancer Society. Are you on?
Yes. For the record, my name is Emily Neenan. I'm the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. Just a quick comment on the bill. I want to thank Representative Keller for clearly taking on a complex issue. There are many pieces of this that do need to be addressed. While this is going through the process, I know this is not the final version, I just want to highlight for the committee that while cancer-related pain is particularly prevalent for those with advanced disease, I'd like to point out that many long-term cancer survivors are living with chronic pain that may require opioid analgesics in order to maintain their quality of life, even though they're no longer in active cancer treatment. So as you're looking at workarounds for dealing with people with chronic conditions, I'd like you to take that into consideration. And would be happy to be a resource, as will my national office and the expertise from around the nation that we can draw on there for dealing with this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see here. Let's go to Judith Dearborn out of Fairbanks, Alaska Association of Nurse Anesthesiologists.
Yes, hello. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
We can.
Okay, my name is Judith Dearborn, and thank you very much for taking testimony today. As you said, I am the president of Alaska Association of Nurse Anesthetists, and for the non-health care-oriented folks, I would like to try to provide a little background on CRNAs and how we are involved in pain management here in Alaska. CRNAs are a type of advanced practice registered nurse prepared at the master's or doctoral level with specialized education in anesthesia and pain management. In Alaska nursing statutes, CRNAs are recognized, quote, as nurse anesthetists, unquote. That language does not appear to have been updated since its institution. By the Board of Nursing Rules and Regs, we are now referred to as certified registered nurse anesthetists. There are currently 99 active CRNAs practicing in Alaska. Of the 9 boroughs in Alaska that have anesthesia services available, 4 have anesthesia provided only by CRNAs. In the rural parts of the state where CRNAs are the only anesthesia or pain professionals available, without CRNA pain management, patients would face much costlier options, including travel long distances to other providers. A little more recent background that's significant, I feel, is that on November 1st, 2012, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, published a final rule on Medicare coverage of chronic pain management services provided by CRNAs. And as of January 1, 2013, CRNAs are to be reimbursed for all Medicare services that are authorized to be performed under their specific state law and scope of practice. And in early January, I was notified that Dr. Bernice Hecker, medical director of the Noridian Medicare Administrative Contractor, or MAC, that operates the Medicare program in Alaska, had reviewed relevant state law and scope of practice of CRNAs in Alaska with the Board of Nursing. She communicated that the Noridian MAC has determined that chronic pain management services are within the scope of practices of CRNAs in Alaska. In the version C, or the working version, I guess, that just came out yesterday, on page 8, line 16, the word, quote, nurse anesthetist has been inserted after advanced nurse practitioner. That was not in the original version. But in closing, I would, because in statutes and regulations, CRNAs are named separately from advanced nurse practitioners, I would again like to simply request that we certified registered nurse anesthetists be included by name in all nursing sections, along with the advanced nurse practitioners on this bill. Thank you very much for your time, and if I can answer any questions, I would be glad to.
Any questions? All right. Thank you for your time. Ann Nelson from Fairbanks, Interior Aid Association. Ann, are you on?
I'm on. Can you hear me?
We certainly can.
Okay. My name is Anna Nelson. I'm the executive director at the Interior AIDS Association, where we operate Project Special Delivery, which is a methadone treatment program. And first of all, we absolutely support the efforts to curb the abuse and overprescription of opiates. There's nothing we'd like more than to be out of business. Our program treats people with long-term chronic addiction to opiates. We are one of two methadone programs in the state. These are the only two facilities where opiates are administered for the treatment of drug abuse in which the dosage prescribed might exceed 120 milligrams. While the requirement for consultation with primary care providers is not wrong, it does not acknowledge the reality of much of the addict population, most of whom have no health insurance and hence no primary provider. Also, some primary care providers contributed to the addiction in the first place, whether they were well-meaning or negligent. There's so many problems with this section for us that I'm not going to list them. I think it should be removed in its entirety at this point. If it's passed as it is, it's a major barrier to the treatment of opiate addiction. And I think it contradicts some of the efforts to curb the prescription drug abuse. Methadone, as administered in methadone treatment programs, is tightly supervised and regulated. The federal regulations, for example, limit the dosage that can be administered at the start of treatment. This means that there's no way for a primary care physician to establish a baseline dosage, and I assume that's the beginning dosage, because the federal regulations require that that's no more than 30 milligrams. In a methadone program, we see our patients almost every day, and the physicians and nurses monitor dose stability and efficacy. We test for drugs of abuse, including other opiates, and we take measures to ensure that the services we provide are safe and effective. We require our patients to participate in counseling and education so they can change their lives, not just their prescriptions. I would say leave this to the addiction-trained medical professionals and have the primary care providers consult with them. Methadone programs are, by federal law, licensed, accredited, and registered. We answer to SAMHSA. We answer to the DEA. We're accredited. We're closely monitored by the State of Alaska Division of Behavioral Health. And this section of the bill does not add accountability, and it interferes with the provision of treatment for addiction.
Oh,
I have to say about that for now.
Okay. Any questions? No. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Representative Seaton.
I didn't quite understand the reference to the baseline and federal law having it no more than 30 milligram equivalent. Is that what you were saying, and how does that relate to what we're talking about in there?
Well, the beginning, this is on page 14, line 9, D, the patient's primary care physician shall screen the patient, actually the next one, C. Oh, need to back up a little bit. The administration of opiates consultation requirement. The healthcare professional who oversees the administration of an opiate for treatment of a drug abuse shall hold a telephonic or electronic consultation with the patient's primary care provider, assuming there is one, to establish a baseline dosage of the opiate before treatment begins.
Okay.
Due to the federal regulations, this conversation is meaningless because that initial dose is going to be 30 milligrams. And then will be adjusted by our program physician slowly to meet the needs of the patient. So this is one example where the consultation or the requirement for that consultation doesn't mean anything.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you. Let's see here. Do we have Dr. Larry Stenson from Anchorage Advanced Pain Centers of Alaska?
Yes. Can you hear me?
We can.
Okay. I'm calling to support the bill in principle. I was a late dialer in, so I missed some of the early discussion, but what I've heard so far, I think most people have very good points. Treatment programs should probably be exempt from the requirements, and cancer pain should probably be exempt as well. The majority of the bill, however, I think is spot on. There is a true problem nationwide and in the state with overprescribing and overdose of narcotics. It's the number one accidental killer of people in the country now, ahead of motor vehicle accidents. And when you're talking about 120 milligram equivalents of morphine, that's quite a bit. this doesn't mean that everybody who's taking pain medication is going to be getting consultations or having to check the database. This is a fairly significant amount of medication. I treat several thousand patients, and I probably have a handful on that much medication or more, and those are for very specific circumstances, primarily related to cancer. But some of the input that's come in so far is it makes it sound like people are going to be shackled. If there are people prescribing large amounts of narcotics to their patients where they would feel shackled by this type of legislation, my question would be, what kind of practice are they engaged in? I think that would be a reasonable question. We were already listening to some of the other qualifications of some of the professionals who engage in chronic pain management. As a physician, you go through 4 years of medical school, go through 4 years of anesthesia residency in my case, and then through a year of fellowship, and then you have to take boards to practice. So by the time you are certified as a pain specialist, you've been through quite a bit in order to have that kind of title, and you have a certain amount of expertise. So I applaud Representative Keller's intentions here. I have talked to the people in Washington State about their outcomes. Gary Franklin, who is the head of the state workers' comp in Washington State, says that they're about ready to publish a paper that shows that 85% of the primary care providers, which I believe includes the nurse practitioners, have been very satisfied with the outcome of their bill and putting the limits at 120 morphine milligram equivalents for their patients. And they have some other data that is very compelling in loss, in decreases in suicides, decreases in ER deaths, in decreases in domestic violence. It's some fairly compelling information, and this is why other states are already pursuing legislation like this. Now, I do agree that there are some things in the bill that need to be definitely modified. And that's why, you know, what I'm looking at right now on my computer screen, it says it's a work draft. So there's some things that need to continue as part of the work draft. But the overall intent is we have a problem, and we have a serious problem. And to ignore the problem is not appropriate. And the purpose of the state medical board, as an example, and I'm assuming the other boards are similar, are to protect the public. And I think this bill goes a long way towards heading in that direction.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that it should be recognized that we're all trying to get our hands around this bill as it's written to figure out how to improve the bill. We're not trying to object. But I just wanted to ask, you know, like the section for doctors, page 3, starting on line 3, where it failed to check controlled substance prescription database before prescribing an opiate, do you have any feeling as whether that's every time there's a prescription or the first time, or are prescriptions written for long periods of time? And that's not with a level of 120. That's for any time you're writing a prescription as the bill's written. I don't know if that is the level where it wants to be for checking the database, but that's what we have before us, and I'm wondering whether your feeling is that every prescription, or if you're on a continuous a treatment of a patient. Can you fill us in on what your feelings would be on that?
Yes. I think that would be cumbersome, the way that is written, and would be difficult to perform, and I'm not sure that the database at this point is reliable enough to make it worthwhile. I do think that if people are exceeding the 120 milligram equivalent threshold, that on a monthly basis, it would not be inappropriate to check that database, because when you start to get to the higher levels, for example, 180 milligram equivalent of morphine per day is a point that has been shown in different studies where deaths begin to increase. And actually, at 120, the risk of death begins to increase. So when you start getting up to 120 or more, and you're prescribing something along those lines, knowing if anybody else is also prescribing an opioid would make a lot of sense, because if somebody else across town is also prescribing something, you've got a patient who is walking a tightrope and is in danger of killing themselves accidentally or maybe not accidentally. And if we're going to be good stewards of the public, I think checking the database when you're in excess of a certain amount would make sense. Checking the database for every prescription would not make sense at all.
Thank you. Representative Reinbold?
Hello, Dr. Stinson? I know you can't see us, so this is this
Caldwell.
Oh, is this Caldwell?
Yes.
Right now?
Right.
This is Stinson. This is Dr. Stinson, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay, Dr. Stinson, I believe you were on the governor's transition team for healthcare. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. First of all, I want to say thank you very, very much. You have extensive training. Thanks for all your years that you went through medical school. I know how hard it is to become very specialized in this area. And all of us on this committee, I think I can speak for to say thank you. We don't want to, you know, adopt a bad bill. And people like you are exactly the type of people that we want to call in and weigh in on this. So through the chair, I'm going to ask, during your testimony, you said that there was a few specific things that needed to be addressed in this bill. I'm going to ask through the chair that we have permission to accept your specific written testimony as public testimony so that we can continue to move forward in the right direction.
I would be honored.
Okay. Thank you. We can. Okay. Looks like it. Is that it? Mm-hmm.
Question.
Okay.
Dr. Stinson, just wondering, you mentioned at the beginning of your comments that the prescription overdose is becoming the number one killer or narcotic overdose. So is that from the instances of people phishing or, you know, if as much as you can tell us about this, so that an individual is going to several providers and getting several prescriptions, or do you think it's more likely that the individual is just overusing the one prescription that they have, just to try and discern where to deal with that problem?
Actually, that's a very good question, because it now, like I said, it supersedes motor vehicle accidents as the number one killer. What they have found is often people have become so tolerant of the medication, which is normal. That's 100% natural. Mm-hmm. Everybody starts to get some tolerance at 6 weeks. They get more tolerance at 6 months. And by 2 years, they're very tolerant. So they keep increasing the dosage to try to get some kind of beneficial effect. Unfortunately, the side effects of the opioids, you don't necessarily get tolerance to. You get a little bit, but not as much as the analgesic effect. And you get into respiratory depression. You get into where you can be so narcotized, you're at risk to basically aspirate stomach contents into your lungs, and that's primarily the way they die. Sometimes that's by accident, sometimes it's intentional. People who fish are often selling the medication, but they're often using it as well. So it's a difficult problem, but most of the time it's from people trying to get somewhere with the medication that they can't get there anymore with that medication.
Thank you.
Representative Reinbold.
Through the chair, Dr. Stinson, I do have one more question. If this law limits people to 120 milligrams, I'm sure some people will be coming down from doses. Isn't there treatment that needs to be available from withdrawal? Being an expert, I would think you would be the person. I just want to make sure that if the law is coming into place, that there's appropriate treatment facilities to deal with the withdrawal.
You know, absolutely. I have people that come into my clinic that I help taper on their medication commonly. That is not an unusual presentation to our clinic. You can also telephonically communicate how you can do this safely. The University of Washington has actually a 1-800 number access line that also has pain experts who give guidance on how to safely taper people on different medication regimens. It's there are ways to do it. There are ways to do it where, as long as people are motivated to do it, and then the flip side is I absolutely applaud the methadone clinics. They're absolutely necessary. They do a good job. And some people need that level of care to come off of their medication.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doctor, just following up on our previous conversation about the checking of the database, is, if we were to retain that in here, is 30 milligrams or 60, or is there some, or is it the 120 where you require consultation? What is the level at which you think the medical community should be required to check the database before either writing or filling a prescription?
I think that monthly at 120 milligram equivalents would be appropriate, because on the epidemiologic data that Washington State has already derived, and I've talked to their chief medical officer as well as the head of their pain program, that's the flexion point that they noticed where bad things started happening in increasing frequency. So I think at 120 milligram equivalents of morphine or more, at least a monthly check, because you're usually writing these prescriptions, rewriting them monthly anyway, it would not be inappropriate to recheck the database. I think at lesser amounts, you're going to, and I'm going to also say something separate here, acute pain and chronic pain are two different things. If someone just had surgery and they're requiring pain medication to whatever extent, because they just had major spine surgery, major cardiac surgery, on those types of things, those should be waived and shouldn't be part of this equation. People who are on opioid medications, and you could choose 3 months, you could choose 6 months, but somewhere around 3 months to 6 months, and if they have an ongoing use at 120 milligram equivalents or more, that's something that then should be watched, because once someone has an acute event, such as surgery, as you heal, your requirements should drop. If they're not dropping, that's a red flag. That could mean that there's an infection, could mean that the surgery did not, that there's other complications of the surgery that should be looked into. Or it could mean that someone is developing into a chronic pain syndrome that probably should result in consultation with a pain management specialist. So acute and chronic pain are two separate things. Post-operative pain, whatever it takes to get somebody comfortable. Cancer pain, I feel fairly much the same way. But once someone is on 120 milligram equivalents or more, definitely by 6 months or more, that is something that really needs to come under further scrutiny, because that is the at-risk group. That's the at-risk population.
Representative Ayak.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to talk about my experience in pain. I'm in pain now. I've been in pain for a very long time, but I've been able to manage it by myself with the help of my wife, who's a nurse. And I've had five surgeries on my knees, and every time I after surgery, as soon as I get up, they want me to start moving, and after I heal, then they tell me to, the doctors keep telling me to keep moving, to move your joints, move your legs or whatever, and I've had arthritis. I haven't gone to a doctor because I know I have arthritis. There's, and my joints started to curl, and I had pain. You can see here, and if I just touch it like that, it just hurt. But I started hitting them on purpose to get, to get my joints moving and everything. So I've been able to tolerate that, and so. when you get on medication, you get a high. I mean, you know, that it's a pretty good high. I mean, you know, I've had a few of them. I should know. And you get used to it, and you want more. But those of us who want to heal, you know, we heal. I'm glad I have a wife. She's a nurse, and that, you know, every time I want to go to the doctor or something, say, just keep moving. So I think that's something that we need to start telling people. I know the doctors do that anyway, is to keep, you know, if you're in pain, just move. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Stinson, we appreciate your testimony. We appreciate your time and your efforts. And most importantly, I appreciate that you were on the phone taking some of these questions from us. And I'm pretty sure we'll have more questions for you down the road. So thank you. Do we have a Dr. Jay Caldwell, Narcotic Drug Treatment Center physician?
Right here.
Go ahead.
I am right here.
Go ahead, Dr. Caldwell.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. My name is Dr. Jay Caldwell, and I'm the medical director for the Narcotic Drug Treatment Center, which is the Anchorage equivalent of the Fairbanks Treatment Center, from whom you heard a little bit earlier. And I'm, first off, I would like to second everything she said. I think the general idea of this legislation is headed in the right direction. And I think Dr. Stinson and Dr. Chandler both pointed that out. I think that there was probably a miscalculation in writing that section 4737175, which has specifically to do with healthcare professionals who use opiates to treat drug abuse. Legally, there are only two kinds of physicians, maybe healthcare professionals, but two categories. One is physicians who have been certified after a certain amount of training to use buprenorphine, which is a methadone substitute and can be used in an office. That's an office-based opiate treatment for opiate-dependent clients. The other group of physicians are those that are at the federally mandated and operated methadone clinics, of which there are two in the state, one in Anchorage, I'm the medical director, and one in Fairbanks. There are no other physicians in the state who are authorized by any kind of federal or state guidelines to treat drug abuse patients, period. The pain management physicians do not treat drug dependence, drug abuse. Family practice physicians certainly do not do that. There have been in the past illicit physicians who have done that and have had their licenses removed, and some of their are in prison at the very moment. So first off, therefore that 4737175 can only apply to the buprenorphine physicians, of whom there are about 30, and the two physicians at the methadone clinics, period. So that legislation has been written then directly at those, at the moment, about 32 physicians, let's say three dozen. The patients at the methadone clinics are an entirely different breed of patients in any kind of family or private practice. Many of them have become opiate dependent as a result of pain and mismanagement of pain, and I think Fairbanks, a lady spoke to that point. These patients are often at the end of their string. They're the lowest of the low in terms of the respectability of people looking for medical care. pregnant women who are addicted. The difference between dependence and addiction is a behavioral statement. People who are addicted are attempting to maintain their opiate levels through antisocial and illicit methods. Dependence is simply a chemical statement. Not everybody who is dependent is an addict, but all addicts are necessarily dependent. Many of the patients who come to the narcotic treatment center, the NDTC, have essentially been rejected by their physicians, literally rejected by their physicians. Many of them come because they feel as if they have been rejected by their physicians. Many patients who come to the methadone clinic do not ever, if they have to go to a physician, we have to beg them, we have to insist that they tell those physicians that they are on the methadone clinic, and they fear to do that because they risk being thrown out just immediately. So the relationship between many of the clients, most of the clients at these methadone clinics is fraught in terms of the rest of the medical profession. So I think that this specific section was somewhat misguided, and I'm sure that you eliminated in toto, as Dr. Stinson suggested and the lady from Fairbanks suggested. So if you need any more testimony attesting to the error of that one particular section, I will chime in also. I should mention finally that two things. One is that there has been some comment about diversion of opiates. That certainly happens in private practice, and unfortunately it happens in pain medicine clinics. The methadone clinics, however, prescribe or distribute only methadone in a liquid form. And it is very, very, very carefully monitored. We keep track of the kinds of medications that people are buying off the street. And the specific kind of methadone in liquid that we provide, because there's a specific color to it, is simply not found on the streets, period. Our clients have to come in on a daily basis to consume their methadone for at least the first 90 days. And only after that period of time, if they have done everything they're supposed to do, and we have a very thorough social program, psychological program, nursing program, if they have met all the criteria, then they're eligible to take one dose home a week. So that is a very rigid kind of thing. And finally, in terms of this concern that seems to be being brewed about overdosing because methadone clinic patients will go to a physician and get more drugs. We test these patients. We will know, we do know, as a result of our urine testing that is on a very regular and unannounced basis. We know what other medications patients are on, and not just other opiates, various kinds of sedatives and whatnot, and stimulants we also know about. So there is a very, very thorough and careful monitoring program, far and above anything that any private physician or any other clinic is going to be able to do, more than happens at the Suboxone physician's offices.
Dr. Caldwell,
so I think you now realize that these specific regulations to have the methadone clinics and the Suboxone physicians talk to the primary care doctors is just something that is not even close to being appropriate, and I'm sure you will correct that. The rest of the legislation, I think, is very well minded, and I'm sure with people like Stinson and Chandler, you can iron out the details.
Dr. Caldwell, we have a question for you from Representative Keller.
Sure.
First, thanks so much for taking your time, Dr. Caldwell. I know it's valuable, and we want to make this bill really good, and your help is much appreciated. I just want to clarify, are you suggesting that the methadone, the two clinics, should be exempt from the bill and not the 30 docs that are authorized with, what do you call it, blupomorphins? And that's one question. Another question I have is When you at the clinics, do you are you is that a normal thing to contact a primary care doc of a person that comes to one of the clinics? Is that part of the process?
Well, we ask if somebody has a primary care physician. The vast majority of our clients don't have primary care physicians. That's number one. We will often, they haven't even been to a physician. We will often detect, we'll occasionally detect a medical problem, and then we will attempt to establish them with a private physician, usually ends up being the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center. So if someone comes in and tells us they have a physician, we will ask them if they would like us to contact their physician. And if they do, which is rare, but if they do, then what we do is we have them sign what's called a release of information that allows us to talk with those physicians. The one kind of primary care physician we always insist that some communication take place is in women who are pregnant. We insist that we be able to speak with those, the obstetricians, whether they're physicians or healthcare providers. So with pregnant women, we insist on that. With other patients, we ask that they have them, and then we go from there. But in any case, we are testing people on a regular basis so we know whether or not they're getting other drugs. Do I think that the Suboxone physician should be exempted from this? Probably. Although I will tell you that they have nowhere near the degree of control and testing and federal regulations that the methadone clinics do. Their clientele is somewhat different.
Dr. Caldwell, we appreciate your time. Are there any other questions? But we appreciate your time and your effort and your testimony, and make sure you stay on top of this with us. All right, is there a Bob Tillman, American Academy of Pain Management?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. I'm the Director of Policy and Advocacy for the American Academy of Pain Management, and for what it's worth, I'm also the Chair of the Advisory Committee for the Kansas Prescription Monitoring Program, so if you have questions about that program, I can answer some of those, too. I'm here to speak today essentially in opposition to this bill. It's unfortunate because we're very sympathetic with the intent of the bill to provide good care for people who are on high-dose, long-term opioid therapy. And in an ideal world, we think the kinds of interventions envisioned by this bill would accomplish that. But we're very concerned that this particular method of achieving that goal is not going to be workable, and that it will have unintended negative consequences for many people who are currently receiving good care, including some whose care doesn't even fall under the parameters of this legislation. And we base that on our experience with this issue in Washington, where these rules went into effect for all prescribers last January, January 2012. Even before the rules went into effect, we were getting numerous reports from people with pain that their primary care providers were ceasing to provide pain medication for them, leaving many of them without any good pain care and some of them in opioid withdrawal. It seems to be that this is due to fear on the part of primary care providers, perhaps because of lack of clarity about what the rules require, but the end result's been a sharp decrease in access to good pain care for most people. We think it'd be wise to let Washington's experiment with this have a chance to show results before emulating it, because we think you want to be sure that it works for the vast majority of people before you sign on to the plan. And while they may have some results, it's hard to believe that those results are really meaningful after only a year of operation of these rules. You've already heard some testimony about the lack of pain specialists in Alaska, and even in Washington, where there are a lot more pain management specialists, one of the architects of this policy admitted on a CNN documentary a couple of months ago that there are access problems for people with pain in Washington. Pain specialists in Washington are also very concerned because they find almost all of their appointment slots filled by these consultations, and the primary care doctors referring these patients seem to assume that the specialist will just take care of the patients rather than providing a consultation. That is, when they try to send the patient back for ongoing care, they find a primary care doctor won't take them back. What we would prefer is that you look at some other interventions, including full funding of your prescription monitoring program, which, as you've heard, runs out of money in August, requirements that all prescribers and dispensers in the state register to access data from that program, the ability for those prescribers and dispensers to designate delegates to help them obtain the reports from the prescription monitoring program, since doing so takes about 5 minutes on average per patient. The ability for the prescription monitoring program to send unsolicited reports to prescribers and dispensers when they detect this sort of phishing behavior you've been talking about. In many states, including our state here in Kansas, we're able to do that. When we find patients who are seeing a number of doctors and going to a number of pharmacies, we're able to send a note out to those folks and let them know that's happening so they won't participate in that any further. We also think you should be looking at some required continuing education for prescribers and dispensers about pain management and about substance abuse screening, diagnosis, and treatment. And we feel that overall, the best course on this, because it's such a complicated problem, may be that you establish some sort of commission or task force or interim study committee to really study the issue and report back to you with some recommendations on how to proceed. And with that, I'll stop, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Rebel?
Through the chair, I really appreciate your solutions. You didn't just come, in opposition. You had four excellent solutions, and I guess I'm requesting that you submit them in writing.
I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. No more questions. Do we have a Ron Green, Narcotic Drug Treatment Center? Ron, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Hey, Ron, you're up.
Can you hear me?
Yes, again.
Okay. Dr. Caldwell has already spoken for the Center for Drug Problems, so I don't have anything else to add other than a comment that I think it was Representative Keller's aide made about the overdoses. I've been with this clinic as a clinical director for over 11 years, and we have yet to have an overdose on this program, and it's, as Dr. Caldwell says, because of our constant urine checks that we do on our people. People should also know that the majority of people who take prescription medication take them as prescribed. It's just that segment of the population, and it's quite a big segment, that has trouble and become addicted to this medication. So I won't add anything else other than that.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yeah.
Representative Keller.
Yeah, thanks again for calling in. What's the largest dosage in the treatment that you give of methadone?
That's a question you should have asked Dr. Caldwell. I'm on the clinical side. The initial dose is 30 milligrams, and then a person can increase their dose after consulting with the nurse and the doctor on a daily basis that they're still showing signs of withdrawal. Then the dose can be increased, but there's no limit to how much methadone a person could be on. We could have people on 150, 200, 300 milligrams if that's what it takes to get that person on a therapeutic dose. But that's a question more suited for Dr. Caldwell.
Yeah, perhaps if Dr. Caldwell is still listening, he would send that information to the committee, but we don't want to take time now. But are you aware of any, are there deaths in the clinic related in the last couple of years? I mean, is there a risk here on the death that we were?
Well, there's always a risk associated with taking prescription medication. I mean, the adverse effects in some medications can cause that. But I've been here 11 years, and this program's been in here since 1974. Dr. Caldwell's been with this program since its inception, as has Cynthia Aiken, our executive director, and she's also the program sponsor. Neither of them have ever told me stories of an overdose on this program. I certainly have never heard of that, and we are concerned about that because in the lower 48 there are about 10% of the deaths associated with methadone clinics are that initial dose that people take, which is why the feds limit it to 30 milligrams. You can't prescribe any more than 30 milligrams on that initial dose because that's the killer dose. The other thing is, our concern is, we have a zero tolerance for benzodiazepines, which is another central nervous system depressant, as is the methadone. And when you combine those two, that's usually what's killing the people. It's not the methadone. It's that combination of two central nervous system depressants, acting upon each other, and that's what's killing people.
Thank you for helping us understand.
Any questions? Nope. Is there a Jennifer with you then?
Yes, I'm here, but Ron spoke for both of us.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Let's see here. Barry Christensen from Alaska Pharmacists Association.
Yes, this is Barry Christensen with the Alaska Pharmacists Association. Can you hear me okay?
Yep. Yes, we can. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I appreciate you taking my testimony. As others have said, we just became aware of the committee substitute bill this afternoon, so I'll limit my comments. I would like to go over just briefly how, from a pharmacy perspective, the PMP program works. And the Alaska Pharmacists Association was involved with the initial drafting, helping draft and craft the legislation for the PMP. So as you are aware, pharmacists and pharmacies fill narcotic prescriptions every day and report that data to a central database. It's not a live, as mentioned, it's not live. In fact, pharmacies typically submit bundles. Our pharmacy submits it 1 month at a time, so we're required to submit at least 1 month at a time. So the data that is posted on the website is at least a month old. So just so you know that. We do have some concerns with the way that the bill is currently written because of the clause saying that pharmacists would have to check every opioid prescription. That would include if you went to the doctor and got some cough syrup or went and got 12 pain pills from your dentist. So we are concerned about the time it would take for that to occur in busy pharmacies. We also have concerns about what would happen if the website was down or the pharmacy didn't have internet access. And, of course, we have concerns about the continued funding of the program. And as we mentioned before, this is a pretty complex issue, and we would probably like to make sure our Alaska State Board of Pharmacy be involved with any kind of anything that has to do with the regulations in the Board of Pharmacy. So with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Reinbold?
Through the chair, this may not be the appropriate time, but do you know if the governor has put in his budget to fund this program?
Through the chair, no, I do not know that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. On page 13, section 14, it's removing the section that says nothing in the section requires or obligates a dispenser or practitioner to access or check the database before dispensing, prescribing, or administering medication or providing medical care to a person. That's being eliminated in here, and I presume that's because of the check. Requiring to check the database. Does the elimination of that section, turning this from a voluntary program into a mandatory program, has the association had any discussion of that and what effect that would have?
Representative Seaton, Chair. We have not, basically because this committee said that wasn't in the original bill, so we haven't had a discussion on that. That basically is a concern of ours. Just as kind of a, I guess you'd say, a personal comment, from my personal perspective as a practicing pharmacist, I use the database whenever I have a concern. So if it's a brand new patient to us, a non-established patient, it's a prescription that either quantity-wise or dosage-wise looks funny, well, I'll go look at it, and I think other pharmacists are the same way. But the idea that we'd have to check, you know, on every single opiate prescription is definitely a concern for us.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? No. Thank you, Barry, for your testimony. We appreciate it. At this time, we have no others that want to testify, correct? All right. Well, this hearing, this bill will be back for us, and so I will leave public testimony open. When we bring this bill back up, we will hear the amendments. So with that, our next meeting will be on Tuesday, February 5th. Whoop.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can we have a little discussion to add
sure.
comments?
You bet.
One of the things I was worried about on the section we were just talking about was nothing requires before providing medical care to a person, and that's being limited. That's on page 13 in section 14. So I would like the sponsor to look at that and find out whether we are, whether there's some unintended consequences that, or providing medical care to a person instead of just the administering or giving a prescription. I think that that might be unintended, maybe much broader removal of language than might be intended. So I just wanted to bring that up.
Is there any other discussion?
Just quickly, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just from the sponsor, if we should expect any of the suggested changes or anything to come before us in a sponsor substitute, or do you want to, we would deal with amendments and then combine things, or just in response to what took place today?
Through the chair. That'll be up to the chair of the committee, but the way I would approach it would be to accumulate everything in a proposed blank CS and then make sure you have it. We all have it before, I promise, 24 hours before the hearing. So
okay.
That's the way I would approach it, but the chair has the prerogative of using it.
Okay. And that sounds, you know, reasonable to me too, you know,
okay.
as far as that goes. So that way we don't have a bunch of amendments coming on that day. So let's try to do that, try to keep it streamlined if we can. Because I have a few ideas too that I want to talk with Representative Keller with. And so hopefully we can get all the amendments in and done.
Okay.
All right. Is there anything else? Okay, let's see. Where was I? All right. So our next meeting will be on Tuesday, February 5th at 3 p.m. and we'll be hearing HB 88. Statutory references to metal retardation, sponsored by Representative Millett. With that said, let's let the record reflect that the Health and Social Services Committee meeting stands adjourned at 4:45.